It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Educators, spiritual leaders, and students will gather in Pittsburgh Sunday and Monday at Rodef Shalom Congregation to discuss anti-Semitism, hate, and social responsibility. Michael Barenbaum is a scholar, author, filmmaker, and director of the Siggy Zering Institute, exploring the ethical and religious implications of the Holocaust at the American Jewish University. He will be one of the featured speakers at that conference, and he joins us in advance of his visit to Pittsburgh. Michael, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You have studied, spoken, written, taught about hate and anti-Semitism for years. What was your reaction to what happened at Tree of Life?
My reaction was overwhelming sadness. I remember the event quite distinctly because I was ironically in Russia to speak at a conference on international anti-Semitism. And little did I imagine that the entire conference would be switched around to confront American anti-Semitism. So it was an incongruous experience and one that hit me very deeply, precisely because of where I was and what I was supposed to discuss that morning.
The conference is hosted by Classrooms Without Borders and the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh to help teachers talk about hate with kids. What is your approach when it comes to starting these conversations?
My approach is very simple, that students are talking about hate all the time. They want to be leveled with, they want to be talked to as serious citizens of the world, and they also want a challenge. And the challenge is, how can they confront it? How can they do better?
Does it differ for, say, maybe a second grade class versus a sixth grade class versus a 12th grade one?
Oh, absolutely. It differs because of the combination of the degree of analysis of which the students are capable, and also because you essentially want to give young students the feeling, a difficult feeling to have. You want to give them the feeling that the world is a secure place and we adults are there to protect them. And what happens with hatred, especially hatred by adults against all people, is that we teach our students precisely what we don't want to teach them, that the world is an insecure place and we're not capable of protecting them. When that's not possible, it's an extraordinary problem for them to grow up with a secure sense of self.
How much would you say most school-age children know about the Holocaust?
Depends where and when, depends how good a job the school is doing. You know, I had an experience earlier this year. I spoke in Manitonka, Minnesota, to eighth graders. And I speak to adults and college students and the like, without, and even high school students, without breaking a sweat. But eighth graders, I wondered, you know, how do you talk to eighth graders? And it turned out that they had read Elie Wiesel's Night. So all I did was to begin to tell them that we had read the same book, we had studied the same literature, tell me what you felt about it. And they had a background to be able to talk very deeply and very movingly about what they experienced. The evidence is that most people don't know a lot about the Holocaust, but they do know very deeply and very profoundly that the Holocaust was awful and evil.
I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest on The Confluence is Michael Barenbaum, who's speaking at an anti-Semitism conference in Pittsburgh starting Sunday. The title of your presentation is Not Your Father's Anti-Semitism, Where Contemporary Anti-Semitism Differs and Why That Matters. So, where does it differ than, say, a generation or two ago?
It differs in profound ways. Number one, we live in a climate in which people feel free to express their hatred, and in which those who express hatred have a megaphone, which is called the internet, and they have a support system that did not exist for hatred a generation ago, and that support system is the social media that allow them to meet people who are like-minded and who share their views. And that gives them amplification for their message, and also gives them permission to express what they're feeling and to express it without having to face a human being. They can express it in the privacy of their home and in the without any measure of consequence. Mm-hmm. Now, when I speak in Pittsburgh, one of the things I'm going to say is that what is not certain in our world, precisely because of the degree of hatred, is whether indeed, and that is that human solidarity is going to hold. And one of the incredible parts of what we have to learn from what happened in Pittsburgh is that solidarity and civility held. And the people who do not hate were given the opportunity to say, we're not going to let this define our community. We're not going to let this define the world in which we live in. Mm-hmm. We're going to protest, and we're not going to be silent, because one of the things we learn is that in the aftermath of evil, if you silence is acquiescence, and human solidarity must be established.
In confronting contemporary anti-Semitism, we're not starting from scratch, though, are we? I mean, there are some lessons learned from the past that maybe are still applicable in combating hate these days?
Well, there are major lessons learned from the past. The other thing that's remarkable, which is surprising, is that according to research, the most popular religion in America, or the most admired religion in America, ironically, is Judaism, while at the same time engendering challenges to it from the extreme left and the extreme right. And it's been a target of white nationalism we've seen all over the place. They've been taken to violence against synagogues, to shootings in California, to an attempted attack in Colorado, to what happened in Pittsburgh. So while on the one hand the data says there are less anti-Semites than before, the anti-Semites are more active and less restrained than ever before. And that's radically different from what we had a generation or two generations ago.
Oregon this year became the 12th state to mandate teaching about the Holocaust. Pennsylvania requires that teachers acknowledge it, but we don't provide much guidance about what that means. If you were writing the rules, what would you suggest Holocaust education look like?
Well, Holocaust education, first of all, should be education about the event that happened, about some of the reasons why it happened. And it should end up essentially with a call to recognize that the diversity of humanity is one of its glories and strength. And a society is strengthened by its diversity and enriched by one another. I would go back to the most fundamental of all American values, which is the notion that we are created equal and endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, that we're among them life and liberty, that we're entitled to respect and human dignity, and that human diversity is, you know, they say that spices enhance the flavor of any food, and society is enhanced by the diversity of its population.
Beyond the classroom, kids often learn first from their parents, their grandparents. Is it harder now with so many survivors of the Holocaust and those who bore witness firsthand now gone?
Well, you no longer have this towering moral voice in our society. It's a voice that's been diminished with time and with age. And consequently, we no longer have it. Where automatically someone walks in and says, this is not for me history, this is personal, this happened to me. And survivors did a yeoman's job of recalling the past in the hopes that they could transform the future. And we certainly are morally diminished by their aging and their leaving this earth. So we have to make up for it. And what I tell students very often is, you are the last generation that's going to be in contact with the witnesses, and you have to become the witnesses of the witnesses and the witnesses for the witnesses.
We've been talking about inspiring students to help combat hate, but how do we open the eyes of adults who are out of school?
Well, I think we open the eyes of adults, first of all, by not tolerating, and that is opposing hatred when we see it expressed and manifest. Saying stuff like, we don't talk like that, we don't behave like that, we expect more of each other. And that means that you use social stigmatization to make sure the conversation does not deteriorate.
There's a well-known quote attributed to Edmund Burke. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. What would you say is our responsibility as a society?
You know, when I teach the Holocaust, I teach about the different roles of different people in the Holocaust. We know about victims. We know about perpetrators. But one of the things we have to look at is we have to look at those who were bystanders and those who were complicitous, with the idea that silence is often assent. And I'm looking to create in my students and in my my colleagues and friends the notion that we have to be upstanders, which is that we have to not be bystanders, but we have to respond to human hatred and offer solidarity with those who are suffering from hatred. And that, I think, is a fundamental lesson that we have to take away from all of this. I think it's one of the things that we saw in Pittsburgh that was extraordinarily impressive and instructive. And the question is, we can't let that merely be a response to crisis. We have to let that be a normal, everyday behavior and a mutual expectation of one another.
Michael Barenbaum is a scholar, filmmaker, and director of the Siggy Zeering Institute exploring the ethical and religious implications of the Holocaust at the American Jewish University. He'll be a keynote speaker at the Anti-Semitism, Hate, and Social Responsibility Conference Sunday and Monday at Rodef Shalom in Pittsburgh. The conference is sponsored by Classrooms Without Borders and the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh. Michael, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. I appreciate it.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. 10% of hardwoods production in the U.S. comes from Pennsylvania, but the industry is feeling the squeeze of the trade war with China. And there seems to be a growth in the number of employee-owned businesses in Pittsburgh. Coming up, we'll take a look at what having a say in the decisions that impact your livelihood does for the success of the company overall. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
If by 1986, Sex Pistols bassist Sid Vicious wasn't already an anti-hero, Alex Cox's film Sid and Nancy certainly made it that way. The film told of the tumultuous love story of Vicious and his girlfriend Nancy Spungen, with Gary Oldman and Chloe Webb in the titular roles. Oldman has stated in interviews that he only appeared in the film because it paid well, but it helped springboard his career. The film has achieved a cult status, and in 2003, Rolling Stone ranked it as the third best rock film ever made. Sid and Nancy was released in theaters in the United States 33 years ago today. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Brian Sawarek.
The Environmental Protection Agency is planning to roll back two Obama-era environmental regulations for coal. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has been reporting on the proposed rules for coal waste stored in unlined ponds and wastewater regulations for coal-fired power plants. And he's here to explain more about what this means. Hey, Reed.
Hi, Kara.
So the EPA is revising two rules. What's included?
Well, the first is the coal ash rule, which was put in place in 2015, and it's to prevent catastrophic failures at some of these coal ash ponds around the country. Also to prevent coal ash from leaking into groundwater. The 2015 rule set some guidelines and deadlines for when plants had to close these coal ash ponds. And the proposed revision allows companies a few more years in some cases to begin closing these ponds down. The second rule governs wastewater from coal-fired power plants, and these plants create a lot of water pollution. And in 2015, the Obama administration upped the standards for what plants had to do to deal with that water pollution. They hadn't been changed since 1982. What the Trump administration is proposing is to increase, in some cases, the amount of pollution that can be discharged from these plants, and to actually allow some more of this wastewater to be discharged into rivers and streams.
Why did the Obama administration create the rules in 2015 in the first place?
Well, in the case of the coal ash rule, it was really a big event. There was a huge coal ash spill in 2008 in Tennessee. It spilled a billion gallons, by some counts, of toxic sludge into nearby homes and rivers and streams. And this really prompted EPA to take a look at the issue.
Why are they proposing these new rules now?
Well, one thing that happened since 2015, aside from the election, is that there were several lawsuits brought by all sides, environmental groups, utilities, states. And some of the rule changes that are proposed are sort of a result of the court decisions. With the coal ash rule, the EPA says if companies are building new coal ash landfills or waste pits, they'll give companies an extension for closing their old leaky coal ash ponds to give them enough time to make their new facility. I mean, these are huge facilities. You know, they take up many acres. And so you can't just build one of these things in 3 weeks. Sometimes it may take years to build. And this is something that the utility industry has really praised about the new rules.
So what are environmental groups saying about these proposed changes?
Well, they're saying, you know, it's not like one big thing that these rules are doing, but they're sort of killing the intent of these rules by a thousand cuts with little extensions and waivers and loopholes. Here's Tom Samar. He's an attorney with Earth Justice.
Instead of having a single strong national set of public health protections for this polluting industry, we are going to be left with federal regulations that are riddled with loopholes.
To this point, there's loopholes in the wastewater rule for plants that don't, say, run at full capacity or that use a lot of water. So there are ways for these companies to sort of avoid the more stringent rules that were embedded in that 2015 rule.
Reid Fraser covers energy for the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania. Thanks, Reid.
Thank you.
There's more, including what it's like to live next to the largest coal ash waste site in the country, just north of Pittsburgh, at AlleghenyFront.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapel.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As the United States trade war with China trudges on, the consequences for one industry could last even after the two countries reach a deal. As WPSU's Ann Danahy reports, the American hardwood industry has been losing business in China as tariffs take their toll.
This is the main entrance to the plant. We actually have a company house on the far back side that's one of the owners lived in for years and raised his family here in Northwest Pennsylvania.
Bo Hammond is hardwood sales manager for Collins Hardwood, a company based in Oregon with locations in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and California. Hammond is giving me a tour of the company's operations in Kane. It's located in McKean County off Hardwood Drive.
So there you're staring at the head rig. That's breaking down the log into its initial form. Then it's going to come over to our resaw and continue to peel boards off down to a certain size.
The company has about 118,000 acres in Northwest Pennsylvania. It started in 1855.
Here at this plant, we're heavy to cherry and soft maple, and then hard maple, red oak, ash, a little bit of birch, some white oak, some poplar.
The market in China has been key to businesses like this one. Its sawmills make industrial products like railroad ties, but it also produces the wood for cabinets and floors, and much of that product had been going to China.
Speaking not just for us, but as an industry, anywhere from 40 to 60% of the product goes overseas, and overseas for the hardwood industry is 90 to 95% China.
That had been thanks in part to a growing middle class in China. It meant a market for hardwoods like red oak and cherry. But then came the United States trade war with China.
The 25% trade tariffs on hardwoods has drastically reduced the amount of hardwood lumber and logs sent to China.
Michael Jacobson is a professor of forest resources at Penn State. He says Pennsylvania has some of the best hardwood forests in the world.
A year ago, everything was great. A lot of our hardwood industry actually depended on exports, and China was the main player. As soon as the tariffs hit, everything changed.
According to the American Hardwood Export Council, the United States had 31% of the hardwood lumber market share in China in 2017. That's dropped to 18% this year. Hammond says the company's plant in Richwood, West Virginia, had to cut the staff in half.
It'll affect us like it has. We've dropped some employees. We're changing how we're doing things. But hopefully we can survive.
This whole new consumption of wood products made with U.S. hardwoods that's occurred over the past 10 years has been a godsend for our industry.
Dean Alenko is vice president of sales for Allegheny Wood Products. It has headquarters in Petersburg, West Virginia, and a sawmill and dry kiln in Marble, Pennsylvania. As the United States raised its tariffs on Chinese goods, China responded, increasing its tariffs, including on American wood. Red Oak, for example, faces tariffs of about 25%.
I've been doing this for 35 years now, and this is the most difficult marketplace that I've played in those 35 years.
Alenko says the industry took a beating from 2006 to 2009, but he says what was different was knowing the economy would get better and you could see the new market in China. But now things keep getting worse.
We were staring into the abyss of tariffs and trade war a year ago. We've fallen so deep in it now that we stand here as an industry and we don't know what's going to happen.
Dana Lee Cole is executive director of the Hardwood Federation. She says about half of hardwood exports coming out of the United States were going to China.
It was consuming a lot of wood that we can't sell here at very good prices, which also supports the domestic industry. It's really gotten pretty desperate for a number of companies.
Hardwood products account for about 63,000 jobs in Pennsylvania, according to a study commissioned by the Federation.
It's all inventory.
Richard Shaw is president of Forest County Wood Products, which packages and delivers wood to school districts and other niche markets. He's not affected in the same way that companies shipping to China are, but he says everyone is affected by the uncertainty.
Are we at the bottom or are we on a ledge on the way down? Nobody knows.
Penn State professor Michael Jacobson says he thinks the industry will have to diversify its markets and find other ways to sell its wood. He and others say when the trade war ends, it doesn't mean China will immediately go back to buying hardwoods from the United States. China is already finding other sources, including Gabon, a country in Africa, and Russia. In State College, I'm Ann Danahy.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Entrepreneurship takes investment, strategy, gumption, and when it's successful, usually a lot of hard work. But it's not all about those at the top. A new model for company ownership is gaining steam, spurred in no small part by the Pennsylvania Center for Employee Ownership. They took part in the region's first citywide task force on employee ownership in September. Kevin McPhillips is the executive director and CEO of the center. Kevin, welcome to The Confluence.
Good. Thank you, Kevin.
And Mark Nicholas is president of the plumbing wholesaler Nicholas Supply, which last year offered an employee stock ownership program. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Kevin, what exactly is employee ownership? It can take different forms, right?
Exactly, Kevin. And first, to sort of put things in context, a lot of people don't realize that as a result of baby boomers who are aging, we're going to see as many as 4 million companies transact over the next 10 years. And business owners have many options, but they don't know about one of them, and it's called employee ownership. Mm-hmm. Many of us are probably familiar with what's called a co-op. You might know a food co-op or a credit union where the members share the value and the profits of the business. But there's another form, and it's called an ESOP, an employee stock ownership plan. And we work across the state to try to educate business owners, government, and citizens about this program. In brief, believe it or not, back in 1974, Congress passed a law that says the following. It says a business owner could sell some or all of their business, 5%, 10%, 20%, or even 100% to their employees. The employees pay nothing, not a penny. Rather, the business takes on a loan from a traditional source like a bank
right.
to pay off the owner over time. The federal government and the state of Pennsylvania turn around and say, look, if you do this, you never have to pay tax again on your profits for whatever portion is owned by the employees. Mm-hmm. And nobody knows about this.
Mm. About how many employee-owned businesses do we have in the region? And any familiar names?
Sure, sure. Well, there's about 300 here in the state of Pennsylvania, right. And about half of those are on the western part of the state. Some of the names that may be familiar are Sheetz, Wawa, which is the sort of eastern Pennsylvania Sheetz, companies like Silver Star Deli, Joy Cones, if you ever had an ice cream cone, and many others.
Okay. And of course, there's Nicholas Supply, Mark. Your father founded the plumbing company, I believe, in 1956. How many employees now?
We currently have 65 employees.
Mm-hmm. And you have different locations?
We have five locations that surround the Pittsburgh market, yes.
When your brother, your older brother, retired in 2013, what options were you considering for the future of the company?
Well, one is to sell your business outright if you choose to do so to a competitor or to a type of company that would investment company. Mm-hmm. The other alternative is just to do the same old, and let it play out. I have three sons in the business and the legacy of my father. I chose to go the route of the ESOP because of it just fit like a glove.
So why not hand it down to the next generation, your kids?
Well, I looked at the employees as an extension of my family. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't see I saw the opportunity for them to be a part of the company, to have skin in the game and to benefit from what the ESOP offers long term. And I think that is a great fit for them as time goes on.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, what do you advise to business owners like Mark when they're considering what might work best? Does it involve, well, how many employees you currently have, the type of business that you're involved in, even people's emotional investment in the company?
Sure, absolutely. First, I don't say this as a platitude, but I think what Mark has done and his wife Martha makes them truly modern heroes. I mean, they are taking care of their employees forever. This legacy is preserved. It may not be for every business. But what Mark has done is found a way to make his company tax-free, and after 3, 4, 7 years of paying off the loan, he's going to have all this extra cash, which is going to make his company grow, create more jobs, and as I said, it's going to preserve the legacy of his business forever. And by the way, to be clear, an ESOP, an employee-owned business, receives full fair market value as determined by an independent appraiser.
But what do you advise them? Does it depend on the type of business and the number of employees?
Yeah, it does, Kevin. That's correct. This is really for a business that's got maybe 20 employees. You know, if you're smaller than that, for a variety of technical reasons, it's difficult. It's really for sort of mid-sized, closely held businesses. And, you know, if you're $200 million, you may be considering an IPO or something like this. Right. This is for a mid-market company.
And 20 and up, because Mark mentioned he has 65 employees.
Yep, exactly, yeah.
Okay. But it is a big move, right? I mean, to hand over sort of the reins, that ownership in a way, to people. Mark, you said they feel like family, but still aren't quite.
Well, in a ESOP, we don't relinquish control. The family still has control. Myself and my three boys are on the board of directors, and we also have one independent person that comes in and sort of advises. We also, with the ESOP, you have a independent trustee, which is a fiduciary. He watches over, making sure that we're doing the right things. And really, it's what we've been doing in the past, we can continue to do in the future.
Yeah, Mark and his family and his executive team will continue to run the business. Employee ownership in an ESOP doesn't mean that the employees vote on everything.
All right. Do they have input, though, on decisions in the company?
On very specific things, such as taking on large amounts of debt or change of control, yes, the trustee speaks for the employees, but the traditional management of the business doesn't change.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about the growth of employee-owned businesses in the region with Kevin McPhillips and Mark Nicholas. So, Kevin, you were involved in a task force in September.
Yeah.
Why something big and official like that? What can getting the city, the state involved do to spur the cause?
Sure, sure. Absolutely. Well, first of all, I want to say that Pittsburgh is really a vanguard city for employee ownership. There's enormously wonderful things happening, new companies such as Mark's coming on regularly, much more than other parts of the country. And the city of Pittsburgh, in support with city council, and in specific Councilwoman Erica Strasburger, we decided to put together a task force of decision makers, folks who could move the dial to raise awareness about employee ownership. So we have members from state government, we have members from city government, we have members, CEOs of ESOP companies, and together we'll be able to raise awareness in ways that we weren't before.
I believe Lieutenant Governor Fetterman is
Lieutenant
on that
Governor
task force.
Fetterman,
and,
yeah.
And of course, our current governor is a former businessman.
Yes, he is.
He's, I believe, sold his company several years ago.
And a strong supporter of employee ownership and what we're doing. Governor Wolf did a lot of things in terms of profit sharing with employees and really buys into what we're trying to do.
So why is it right for Pennsylvania? I mean, why should the state care who owns it or even how it transitions a company? Mark, and then
I'll,
Kevin?
I'll pipe in here. When you look at our industry, in particular, my competition, they've all been bought out. I'm the last family wholesale plumbing supply house, full line, left in Pittsburgh. My competition's all from either in the Ohio region or eastern Pennsylvania or Virginia. And so it keeps the money that is spent in our company is that those dollars circulate throughout the community of Pittsburgh. And whereas these other ventures or the money's going out of Pittsburgh into other parts of the country.
Employee ownership keeps jobs here in Pennsylvania. It creates jobs. It saves jobs from leaving the region, and it bolsters the economy. And all those things, Kevin, are things that governments are very interested in.
That idea of the possibility of losing jobs, mm-hmm. If you're selling to somebody out of state. Mm-hmm. Mark, do any of those concerns sort of resonate with you? They sound familiar?
Very much so. The administrative portion of our company would virtually disappear if I would have sold to a larger entity.
You had that option, though.
I had that.
Was it outside the state or still in the region? Or still in Pennsylvania?
As far as a company buying us out, I had offers from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So why didn't you?
Well, I my loyalty is to my family and to my employees. And I look at that as a much greater gain in the long run to have that stay within the context of the company.
Right. Kevin, do you find, in addition to the option of employee ownership, mm-hmm. Employee stock ownership, selling out of state,
sure.
Do you find that some companies just plain close up shop?
They do, Kevin, and it's a very good point. That's what we're worried about. You know, large numbers of companies transacting over the next few years, and what we don't want to see is them disappear or go away, whether they're small businesses in Lawrenceville or they're larger businesses in the Cranberry region. We want to see them stay here and continue to bolster this economy. Mm-hmm. We also have the problem with individuals who don't have retirement funds. The employees at Mark's business are going to have real retirement now, okay? Something they may not have had otherwise. They're going to have a share of the profits in the business. Business is going to grow. The owners are going to do tremendously well. And the employees are going to have a future.
Why do some possibly or do close up? They just don't have a plan for how their company is going to live on?
Exactly. I mean, it's horrible to think about this, but today 70% of businesses are owned by people over 55, and yet 70% of those say they have no plan for succession. So if we learn nothing from today, think about having a succession plan.
Mm-hmm. So is that part a matter of age? Because you mentioned 55 mm-hmm. and above. Is it interest? Even the passion of one generation to own something, to own a company, and maybe less so for their sons and daughters or even their grandkids. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm the second generation, and my children are the third, and their kids, I've got grandchildren that are 14 and 15 years old. That's the fourth generation. So if you don't have that succession plan, where are you going with that? So they look at that as, well, I'm either going to close up shop or I'm going to sell out to another entity.
Yeah, exactly. We have to be thinking about the future. We have to be thinking about the next generation. And I think that we have so many additional options today in terms of employment paths, and not as many next generations are actually following up necessarily in the family business. They may want to go and do something else. All the more reason why we need to have options for people.
The employee ownership, do you find that the proposals, the idea sort of percolates? Does it come from the top down or the bottom up? In other words, by employee or employer?
Right. Yeah, good question. Yeah, today I would say it's definitely something that is about the business owner today. It's about the decision process of what am I going to do with the business when I'm ready to retire or do otherwise. Now, a day may come in the future as awareness kind of raises that other populations, employees, et cetera, may see this as something to discuss with their owners, but we're not there yet.
All right. We have just a couple of minutes left. Mark, what would you say to business owners, maybe on the fence about employee ownership, maybe considering an outright buyer over existing employees?
Well, I go back to the employees and how do you feel about your employees? And are they, you work with them every day for 8, 9, 10 hours a day, and they're like family. And my father had that viewpoint up to his retirement and past his retirement. And my brother and myself had that view, and I've carried that. And the employees are so important. They've built the company. It isn't just the owner that takes all the credit. It's a consortium of all of you working together. And I think looking at it from that point of view, you invest in your employees, and we do a lot of training and things of that nature. So having that point of view and carrying on the legacy of the company, which allows you to do, is a positive, and it's just a win-win situation throughout the whole organization.
And Kevin, very briefly, what about risk? Employees as a group, maybe the company doesn't have the economic resources in case of an economic downturn. What do you advise? What support do you lend?
Sure. Well, needless to say, employee ownership or any other form is not a magic bullet. You need to run your business well. And certainly a business can struggle. But what I'll tell you is that during the recession, employee-owned businesses were 92% less likely to lay people off. They find ways to do it. They take the strength, as Mark said, of the employees, and they keep the companies going.
And in our last 30 seconds, so what's next, whether it's this task force or the efforts?
Sure, absolutely. Well, employee ownership isn't just about Pittsburgh and about Pennsylvania. There are national efforts going on as well. The National Center for Employee Ownership in Oakland does a wonderful job as well. But our goal is to try to raise awareness, build a model here in Pittsburgh that could be expanded out to other municipalities, not just in the state, but also nationwide, so more and more people know about this remarkable program.
How can people get in touch with you or find out more?
Sure. They can visit us at ownershippennsylvania.org. And we'd be happy to speak to anyone.
And we'll have that link on our website, WESA.FM. Kevin McPhillips is the Executive Director and CEO of the Pennsylvania Center for Employee Ownership. Mark Nicholas is President of Wholesaler Nicholas Supply, which shifted to an employee-owned stock option model just last year. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you. Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you missed anything from today's program, or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Avery Keatley. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin, and until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.